Hello and welcome to this special edition of Arena, coming to you tonight from Dún Laoghaire in County Dublin. It is the RTE Short Story Competition Awards night live from the Pavilion Theatre. You're so much better than last week's audience. 2,000 stories down to a shortlist of 10 in this long-running literary competition in honour of Francis McManus. Tonight, we'll hear who has won the top prizes of 5,000, 4,000 and 3,000 euro. We've been enjoying listening to the stories on RTE Radio 1's Late Date, reading them on RTE Culture and talking to a few of the writers on Arena over the last couple of weeks. Now, this year's writers are here sitting anxiously in the front row. Hello to all of you. Shortly, we'll be hearing from all of their stories in live performance and from our esteemed judges Neil Hegarty, Jan Carson and Tristan Rosenstock. But first to music. It's hard to believe it's been 25 years since the release of The Big Romance, the album that helped define a moment in Irish music and introduced us to the songwriting of David Kitt. To mark the anniversary, he's announced a special concert at the National Concert Hall next April, where he'll perform The Big Romance in full with friends and collaborators, old and new. We're delighted he is here with us now. He's going to play us a couple of songs this evening. We'll kick off with the first track from the album, Song from Hope Street, Brooklyn, New York. Please welcome David Kitt.
Same old lines, hope on my street, people pace just like a broken beat, just like a broken beat. Seven steps take me to your door, seven steps, each one a broken beat, each one a broken beat. And there's one more hour in my day, and that's alright. And there's one more hour in my day, and that's alright. We step in, I see another door. This old room feels like an overcoat, feels like an overcoat. Window down, two people on my street, see their smiles somewhere an overcoat. Somewhere an overcoat. And there's one more hour in my day, and that's all right. And there's one more hour in my day, and that's all right.
Thanks to David Kitt. He's going to be playing The Big Romance in full with friends and collaborators, old and new, at the National Concert Hall, Friday, April 10th of next year, 2026. But those tickets go on sale next Tuesday, and you'll find out more details at davidkitt.com. to this year's shortlist for the RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. The stories are available to read and listen back on rte.ie/culture. They've been broadcast on Late Date, and of course we've been talking to some of the writers on Arena. Let's remind ourselves of the titles and authors. They are A Spectrum of Sorrow by Angela Finn, Auntie and Anto and Ivy and Ava by Ian Feary, Caron the Magina by Neil O'Sheill, Feeding Time by Sinead Troy, It Must Have Come First by Sage Omar, Kazakhstan by Kevin McDermott, Labels by Mary O'Rourke, Pool Story by Jill Kenny, Witness by Linda McCarthy, and Wolves by Peter McCauley. To our judges joining the panel this year, Jan Carson. Jan is the author of 3 short story collections and 3 novels. Her awards include the EU Prize for Literature for Ireland, and of course she is no stranger to short stories for the radio. She's been broadcast many stories here on RTE Radio 1 and also on BBC Radio 3 and BBC Radio 4. The next highly anticipated novel, Few and Far Between, is coming from Doubleday in 2026. Also new to the judging panel this year, Tristan Rosenstock is an arts broadcaster with RTE Radio na Gaeltachta. His debut Irish language book for young readers, Inish Mara, was selected for World Book Day 2024, and Inish Mara 2 was published not long ago. He's the literary editor of CORE, and he's on the board of the Irish Writers' Centre and Poetry Ireland. And returning judge, Neil Hegarty, author of an impressive and wide-ranging number of books, both fiction and non-fiction. His novels include The Jewel and Inch Levels, which was shortlisted for the Kerry Group Novel of the Year. He is the co-editor of the essay collection Impermanence, and he too has published short stories widely in the Dublin Review, Stinging Fly, Tangerine, and elsewhere. And now I've made it to the end of all of your incredible list of achievements. You can applaud them if you can. You can. We could have gone on all night. Neil, you were judge on the competition last year too, so what has the judging process been like for you this year?
It's been very collegiate. It's been very, very interesting. It's been about choosing your champions, but being open to the champions of Jan and Tristan as well. And it's been, like last year, a very, very stimulating couple of months. And perhaps I could also say, just at this moment, I think we're all very aware that this time last year, Sean was here, Sean Rocks. And I just thought I would take a moment to say, to reflect on what a loss it has been to his family, first and foremost, but obviously to the arts as well, and to broadcasting in this country, and to this competition, of which he was such a huge champion.
And Sean's partner, Catherine, is here with us tonight, and we'd like to thank her and her family for joining us. Tristan, I want you to put your broadcasting hat on. I'm interested to know about the style of stories that were submitted this year. Do you think that a lot of the writers were possibly writing them knowing full well that they were going to be read and on the radio?
I hope so. We did advise initially to go easy on dialogue because that can be very difficult for an actor, particularly if there are multiple characters, he said, she said, then he said. So I think a lot of them were written with radio in mind. Certainly when I read them and I read certain extracts out loud, you know, they sat very nicely on the ear, and it's been a pleasure listening to them over the last 2 weeks on Late Date. If you have a few hours over the course of this weekend, the long weekend, I highly recommend going online and just sitting down and spending time with these stories, because you know, reading them is one thing, but they jump to life, really. They really leap off the page when you hear them read. And Sarah Binchy did a fantastic job with the casting. I think that the pairing of actor and story throughout was so strong and really well cast.
And Jan, for a newcomer to the judging process here, how was that? Was it harmonious?
I don't know, ask me later, I'll be honest. No, it was really, really wonderful. And can I just say, over 2,000 submissions, folks. I think that's absolutely astounding. It shows us that there are so many new, incredible writers out there that we haven't heard from yet. And I know full well what it's like to sit where you guys are sitting in the front row and maybe not be in the top three tonight, but can I say the quality of everyone in the shortlist is amazing this year, and we're all excited to read whatever you do next.
Okay, we're going to move on to our first story. It is It Must Have Come First by Sage Omar. Jan, you loved the weirdness of this story. Tell me about it.
I love anything weird, Rick, to be honest. I'm really, really jealous of Sage's imagination. It's just fantastic. It's a story about a breakup and a person who becomes obsessed with an egg that starts to take over their life. I was impressed by the really, really mature use of the second person. I was particularly impressed by how you held on to an extended metaphor and it never grew tired or waned. And that ending, it creeped us out in the very best way, and that's a high compliment from me.
Okay, let's hear an extract from It Must Have Come First by Sage Omar. This is read by Katrina Niboraku.
One night, you're going through his things. In his hurry to get to the blonde, he's left all his nice shirts. You lay them on the bed, next to your basketball-sized egg, and go back to the closet. When you turn around, the shirts are gone. You look around, unsure if you're alone. Suddenly the house is so quiet, so empty. Then you look at your egg. Of course you're not alone. You lay another shirt by the egg and look away again. When you turn back, it's gone. You remember his favorite cashmere jumper is folded in a drawer downstairs.
Thank you, Katrina. That's an extract from It Must Have Come First by Sage Omar, who is here with me. Sage, what is the egg? Are we allowed to ask that?
What isn't the egg? I wrote the story, I didn't have a specific interpretation of the egg in mind. I think I've been really interested in all the different interpretations that have come to me. I've heard allusions to motherhood, to kind of figments of delusion, mental illness. Some people have thought it was a literal mythological Game of Thrones-style egg. That one I can confirm it's not. But yeah, I love writing open-ended stories and open-ended endings, so I can't actually tell you what the egg is.
Sage Omar, thank you so much for that. Cheers. Our next story is Feeding Time by Sinead Troy. Andrew Bennett is standing by to give us a flavour of the story. Very appropriately for the day that's in it, the theme of the story is what we might call election blues.
You see him for the first time in the afternoon. You weren't actually expecting him to appear physically in front of you. A few hours ago, he was just a shadowy nobody venting into the chasm of the internet. Fiona is stunned into worried silence. Is she your daughter? He asks in mildly slurred speech. Your voice is steady and your tone is neutral. That is no concern of yours. If you don't have an issue to raise, I'm going to have to ask you to step aside. You want to see my daughter? He asks. You hear Fiona's voice. Dad, this is Bill Kenny, Lisa Kenny's dad. Bill Kenny doesn't resonate with you any more than Liam Kenny did, but the name Lisa Kenny rings clear as a bell. Would you like to see my daughter? He asks again. I'd love for you to see her. I'd love for you to find her the way that I did.
That is an extract from Feeding Time by Sinead Troy, and the reader was Andrew Bennett. Neil, in that extract, there's something very tricky happening for that politician who's out on the canvas. Tell me a little bit about the story and what it was that you and your fellow judges liked about it.
So it's a very familiar scene. It's a local politician out on the stump, on the canvas, and then something appalling happens, and it suddenly moves from a familiar scene into a scene of distress. And I think what I was very impressed by, and what I think we were all very impressed by, is the way that Sinead handled that ethical move. Because it's not an easy thing to write about ethics, that shift into distress And Sinead handles it so well, and we were all very impressed by it.
It's told in the second person as well. What's the effect of that choice?
It brings you very, very close, but it still gives you a little bit of space around. It still isn't used very much as a medium, and I think it could be deployed a whole lot more in all of our fiction. It sets you free in a very interesting way, I think.
Okay, that's our second story tonight, Feeding Time by Sinead Troy. Our next story is As Gaeilge. The competition is open, of course, to stories in Irish as well as in English. And this year's Irish language entry on the shortlist is Coran na Maidhne by Neil O'Shiel. Tristan, this is the story of a young Donegal girl. She's out for the night with her friends in London, but that's not all that's happening. Tell us what caught your attention about this story.
So we're second person again, actually, in this story, but the story starts with a statement, "Oh, you're wearing makeup." And it's a very snide, simple comment that her partner, her fiancé, throws her way as she's leaving to go out a night out, and it rattles her, it stays with her for the night, so much so that when she arrives at her party, somebody compliments her on her appearance, and the first thing she splutters out is, "I'm wearing makeup," you know. So it's a very loaded comment. There's an insinuation there, there's an accusation there maybe, a veiled accusation, who are you dressing up for, basically. And over the course of the evening with her friends, this young woman realises how withdrawn she has become. So this is a story really about coercion, about a controlling relationship. And ultimately she reflects on the big decisions she's made throughout her 20s. You make a lot of very important decisions in those years, what you'll do career-wise, who you might end up with romantically. And she's questioning every decision she made. She's wondering, did I do these things because other people expected me to follow these, to tick these milestones, or did I make the choices that I wanted to make? So ultimately it's about a young woman feeling comfortable in her own skin, with or without makeup, she'll decide.
Okay, let's hear a little of that story read by Katrina. This is the opening section.
Tronona de Hina Lauren Tauri Tatu Oak Fos Scarin and Sluos the Horde and in Valach Gideon Stashun and Chahir Oskil Trout Yukach Lat Gaida Ianu Tasmidiort Agus Guna Carnini Sugruig Mal Alive er the Rulin Agus Bert Biog Cludaha Gusnasta er the Wacklin following thread and stashun, she is in style to bio. Fuim the trainer in the closer. No dersha eg oskult gahul, dear nor a lagantu cuss or an ardon. Tugan lundin arahut, o am gaham.
Neil, it's an intriguing title, Coran the Margin. Coran meaning crescent, but meaning sickle as well. Where did that come from?
Well, when I lived in London myself, it was a constant game we always had in the Irish community, the Irish language community, to translate the place names there. So one of my last trips over, we were out and about in Mornington Crescent, and I thought, what would that be, Mornington Crescent? Coran the Margin. But that made me think of, well, Coran is also sickle, like you say, so the sickle of morning. Made me think of a fateful decision, a moment when things change.
How important is it for you to write As Gaeilge?
It's an interesting question. People sometimes ask why, and I don't have a very satisfactory answer to that. But the best thing that somebody said to me was, "Oh, it's your impulse," and I thought that was perfect. You know, I think artists work by instinct really more than reason or logic. Certainly, I don't. For me, it just feels right, you know, it's comfortable, and there's so much going on with Irish these days that it's great to be part of it.
Neil O'Shiel, thank you so much for joining us. Just like all of the stories, this one is available to read on rte.ie/culture, but we've just published a literary translation in English of the story there as well for anybody who would like to read that. It's by Catherine Duffy, herself a past prize winner in this competition, Coran na Maidhne by Neil O'Shiel, translated as Sickle of Morning. Thank you, Neil. Let's hear from our next story. Katrina is standing by to read an extract from Witness by Linda McCarthy.
Until a few months ago, her youngest would still crawl up beside her on the couch,
and put his head on her lap when the house was empty. She would push curls back from his forehead and pretend to keep reading her book, ignoring pins and needles or a full bladder, just to keep him there a minute longer. But that's all stopped now. The looming prospect of secondary school pushing him towards his brothers and the world of men and away from her. Most days she moves through the house like a ghost, ferrying laundry from room to room, making meals that are eaten or uneaten, but never acknowledged either way. In his first few weeks in the house, the student would loudly thank her, as if he could prompt her family into doing the same. He wasn't long giving that up, though, and instead he just catches her eye and nods. It makes her uneasy to think how grateful she is for that small recognition.
That is from Witness by Linda McCarthy. Jan, there's a real sense of tension in this story. What's going on here?
Essentially, it's another story about coercion in a relationship. It's a woman who has a very domineering husband and her youngest son. She wants something different for him. I love this story. I think it's a very sophisticated piece of writing, Linda. It's really difficult to write women particularly moving towards autonomy in a believable way that isn't oversimplified. And here we see the main protagonist taking small steps of resistance in a way that you really start to root for her. And the other thing that I loved is, oh my goodness, Linda, your sentences are just gorgeous. You can hear from that short reading there, they're clean. They're sometimes really punchy and they just get right to the heart of the story. It's a really accomplished piece of writing.
That's Witness by Linda McCarthy. Our next story, Kazakhstan by Kevin McDermott. Neil, this is a story about a widowed retired vet. Somebody comes into his and his son's life, a future daughter-in-law. Tell me a little bit about what the judge has made of it and about the relevance of the title as well.
Kazakhstan. On one level, there is a character who steps into this family and she's from Kazakhstan. So it's a story about our change into a multicultural society and how that goes in this family. I think we were also aware that Kazakhstan has a kind of it has a magic about it. It has a spell which is woven through the text. So Kazakhstan, as you read it, you begin to think of the night sky, the stars in the night sky, which is a big theme in this book, and it indicates a kind of a shimmer of something special which is happening and about to happen to this family, and it shows that there is grief in the background of the story, but it shows that you can write about happiness, you can write about transformation, and you can make a really good story out of those great themes as well.
It's quite a dreamy and quite a sort of hopeful story as well, though, isn't it?
It's hopeful. I'm not sure that it's dreamy, because it's exactly the kind of scenario, the kind of story that can happen to any family if they're open to that transformation happening. And that's why it really put a smile on my face as I read it.
And it's putting a smile on the faces of the judges now, even when you're talking about it. We're going to hear from Kazakhstan by Kevin McDermott. Andrew is going to read us a section now.
John arrives in with his girl. She is small and slight. She reminds me of a newborn calf trying to find a foothold on this earth. She has calf eyes, big round pools that you could lose yourself in. Da, this is Lara. She holds out her hand. I take it and shake it gently. That's a lovely name, I say, like Dr. Zhivago. She looks confused and turns to John. Please? It's only then I hear the accent. Where are you from, Lara? Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan, be the Hokie. And there was me expecting you to say Nerney or Mount Rath. Lara's a bit shy about her English, John says. But my Kazakh isn't the best, I reply with a laugh, and my Russian's no better. It surprises John, me knowing that much. I have a pal, you see, a department inspector who did a stint in Kazakhstan advising the government.
And that's an extract from Kazakhstan by Kevin McDermott, read by Andrew Bennett. We are, believe it or not, halfway through our stories now. We will be back with the second half of tonight's RTE Short Story Awards, coming live from the Pavilion Theatre after this break. You are listening to Friday Night's Arena. We are live in the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire with the judges and writers from this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. On the subject of the great writer and RTE broadcaster Francis McManus, I'm delighted to welcome his son Paddy McManus, who's here in the audience with his wife Moira, and we are honoured to have their company here tonight. Now let's move on to our fifth story. It is Labels by Mary O'Rourke. Tristan, set the scene for us on this one. What's this story about?
We were talking earlier on about Kazakhstan, and Neil had a big smile on his face reading it. I was thinking of, I listened to the recording of this on the Lewis a few days ago again, and I must have had a big smile on my face because the person sitting opposite me said, what are you looking so happy about? So it's probably one to read or to listen to at home on your own, as is Mary O'Rourke's Labels, but for very different reasons. This is a powerful piece of writing. It's a portrait of a woman suffering from bipolar disorder. Labels is the title, and she refers to the various labels that were given to her throughout her life. So we're kind of looking at the idea of these labels. She's trying to remove them, by the way. She's actively trying to remove all these labels. She doesn't like being identified by them, which is very understandable. And so she spends a lot of her time struggling with these labels. She comes up with some of her own that are, I suppose, born out of her own lived experience as a woman suffering from bipolar. So rather than elation and despair, she prefers heaven and hell as a better description of the condition she's living with. This is a really moving piece of writing and just a stunning portrait of a woman caught in the grips of bipolar.
It's a bold stylistic choice not to punctuate the story. It's a stream of consciousness, yeah. Really. What's the effect on the reader and maybe on you as judges, Tristan?
Yeah, it's one to take your time with, certainly. I had to return to some sections and try to find the music, find the meter, find the start. But that's very enjoyable. And I think this is one of those stories, the more you read it, the more you'll enjoy it. And the recording, of course, is a huge addition as well. But we're used to stream of consciousness writing. We've seen this before. And I think, you know, anyone who is an avid reader will have encountered something like this before. But it's definitely one to take your time with.
Okay, let's hear from the opening of Labels by Mary O'Rourke, read now by Katrina.
When she was 9, she knew about monophthongs, diphthongs, triphthongs, about breathing deep into the diaphragm. She knew too about the G clef, andante, allegro, crescendo, decrescendo, common time, rallentando. But it was not until 40 years later that she was able to distinguish between a direct debit and a standing order. What was all this about 40 that fascinated her? Was it the 40 years which the Israelites spent in the wilderness, or the 40 days that Jesus fasted in the desert before starting his public life that was the origin of Lent? Or was it the 40 days he spent on earth after his resurrection? Or maybe it was the 40 years it took to build the temple in Jerusalem? More likely, it was the day 40 years ago that they stuck a label on her forehead and told her she had bipolar. It would have been so much nicer if the label said good-looking, or good-fun, or bright, or this girl will go places. But no matter how she tried to unstick the label, it was not for moving. So she had to become friends with it and embrace it as part of her life until eventually it would become unstuck of its own accord. In the meantime, when she brushed her teeth or put on lipstick, the label would stare back at her from the mirror. It was not even pretty. The only thing was that thankfully nobody else could see the label. And for that, she was grateful.
Mm-hmm. That's Katrina Nivoracu reading from Labels by Mary O'Rourke. Mary is with me. Mary, the opening section sums it up. The narrator is grappling with being given that label of bipolar depression. Despite the subject matter, though, it's a light read, it's a gentle read, it's a funny read as well. How did the story come to you?
Well, in my lifetime, I do myself have had experience with some mental illness, and I thought, why not look at some at a particular diagnosis that could be taken as very, very difficult and look at it in a light-hearted way and in a type of black humour, just make fun of oneself and just that every challenge can be overcome given the right circumstances, the right determination, and that really and truly the story sort of wrote itself, and that's why I used stream of consciousness method. It just ran away like a driver would be driving without a steering wheel, really. And the imagination just took off. And you know what the funniest thing of all was? At the end of the story, there's reference to her being, as she thought, being inaugurated as president of Ireland. And what are we doing today? Except we're electing a president of Ireland. No, that's all I have to say.
Mary, thank you so much for that. We have to move on to Pooled Story now by Jill Kenny. I was talking to Jill a few nights ago on Arena. Let's get a flavour of the story. Andrew is now going to read from an early section.
Changing rooms. One friend already in his trunks and flip-flops leaning against a locker. The other with a two-day stubble is shoving things into a locker and asking if either of them has a euro for it. Tim gives him his only euro, takes off his nylon tight branded top, strips down to his briefs, leaves his locker shut but unlocked. Here, you don't have trouble with the lads stealing stuff. It's if you accused them, you would. They walk together past the sign that says, "No video photography." Sean, who was recently laid off with his da when the ribbon factory closed, was the reason. Slipped his phone's camera under the next cubicle a few years ago, pretending he just dropped it, that it was recording by accident. He made such a deal of it, nearly like it happened to him, that he just got barred for the year.
Jan, we get a sense, even in that short extract, that one of the themes of this story is masculinity and its discontents. What did you and what did the judges like about it?
So I think there are probably many women in the room tonight who knew how awkward it is when you're in the jacuzzi and a bunch of men get in with you. And what we maybe don't know is the perspective from the other side, what it's like for a man in that situation when you understand the awkwardness of what's going on. Probably don't do anything about it either. And that's where Jill has really hit upon a really nuanced portrayal of masculinity here. This is a character who is aware of his own complicitness in some of the toxic behaviour that's going on, and also objective enough to see that he doesn't really want to be part of this world. That's very, very clever writing. And the second thing that I really liked about this is it's an incredibly visceral piece. You can smell the chlorine, you can taste the chips they're going to have after they go for their swim, you can hear the bubbles in the jacuzzi, and I really loved that. It made me want to go for a swim afterwards.
Makes me want to go for a bag of chips. On to A Spectrum of Sorrow by Angela Finn. Neil, this is an exploration of grief and its aftermath, but like the last story, despite the theme, there's a lightness, isn't there? What's going on in this story?
Yeah, the protagonist is experiencing grief, and this story stays with her through that process, and you begin to see what can happen after grief, what can happen if you allow yourself to grieve, to feel grief, and then is there anything that can happen after that? And I think in this story, Angela shows us that if you're patient with yourself, any form of transformation can happen as a result. We're not quite sure how, but it is possible, and that's enough for any reader or any listener. It's a very heartening story, in spite of its opening, in spite of the fact it's about something terrible that's just happened to this person.
Okay, we're going to have a listen to the opening of A Spectrum of Sorrow by Angela Finn, read by Katrina.
Inside the hospice, I wanted to hug her, but could not. April sunlight shone through the corner window and fell in lemon pyramids across the bed. It was lunchtime and the ward smelled of soup. She wore navy blue pajama bottoms with a pattern of white anchors. I blew her a kiss and shaped my hands into a heart. A week after the funeral, a letter came to the house letting me know my carer's allowance had ceased. At the social welfare office, I spoke to an inspector through spit-speckled plexiglass. She handed me a form and said, "Next time you come here, bring proof that you're looking for a job."
And Angela Finn is here with me now, if slightly reluctantly coming up on stage. Angela, it started life as a prose poem, I believe. Tell me about how that came about.
Yeah, I was doing an MFA in UCD and I was experimenting with, I write poetry and I write short stories. So this started life as a very long poem. So it was called the First 35 Stages of Grief. And then I read a newspaper article about a carer who, the person she was caring for had died, and she was basically told that her allowance, carer's allowance, was cut off, and it was a bit of a shock. So I tried to imagine that character kind of going through the grief, and I sort of incorporated that with the poem, and this is the result.
It's okay, Angela, you're allowed to go back into the darkness. Angela Finn, thank you so much for joining us this evening. We are on our way to our next story. I'm going to ask Katrina now to read from Auntie and Anto and Ivy and Ava by Ian Feary.
Dad catches me on the way back downstairs and puts €20 in my bag. "You pay for lunch, all right," he says quietly. I roll my eyes. "Dad, Auntie Kira wasn't actually being serious about me paying." "Well, maybe get your big sister a teddy or something in the shops. She doesn't get to go out for girly days like you." "Ava won't like a new teddy," I say as we go down. "She only likes new." Mam makes me say goodbye to Ava before I leave. Ava is on the couch watching Bluey on her tablet with her big headphones on. She flaps Nunu, the stripy rabbit teddy, in my face and screeches like she always does when she wants to be left alone. Nunu's black eyes watch me leave, reminding me that he knows what I did.
Neil, we had Ian on Arena a few nights ago. He was talking about how he reads out the dialogue and makes sure that every line is true to the way a child would speak. That child's eye narrative is a very tricky thing to get right, but this is a really good example of the form, isn't it?
It's a perfect example of the form. It stood out for all of us, I think, as an example of one of the child-centric narratives in this year's competition. It brings out all the vividness of a child's life, the turmoil in their head, and I was really, really struck when I heard Ian on Arena. Because I thought, well, it absolutely shows. It shows in the way the story runs. It rings clear every single sentence, every single line, every single thought. And actually, I think for what it's worth, I think every writer should read aloud everything that they ever write, because you get something else from it. Something will ring true or it won't ring true. And you'll get that if you read it aloud. So bravo, Ian, I would say.
A lot of nodding heads again from our judging panel. We're at our final story already. Derry writer Peter McCauley, he was shortlisted a couple of years ago, and he's back this year with Wolves. Tristan, set the scene for this one for us, if you don't mind.
It's quite a strange story, actually. So John, the protagonist, returns to Derry from from Manchester, and I suppose when he gets home, he finds that things aren't as he remembered. His brother Rory is clearly suffering from mental illness, leaving his mother, a stoic dairy woman, really serving as his carer. It's interesting that a lot of the stories kind of honed in on things that have been part of the public discourse in recent years. We had a few stories earlier on about coercion, coercive control. A couple of stories about the important role carers play in Irish society. And this woman is essentially her son's carer. And she's protecting him at nighttime from real or imagined threats. He thinks there are wolves parading around Derry and getting ready to attack the house. So I suppose John is, I love the open-ended nature of this story because we don't get answers, you know, so we're left wondering, will he stay? Does he realise what he's come home to? Will he bolt it back to Manchester? He realises his mother won't be around forever. Who'll take care of Rory? All these realisations occur to him as he comes home following his stint abroad. It's a beautiful piece of writing and just another one that highlights the role that carers play in Irish life.
Okay, let's hear an extract of Wolves read by Andrew.
John staggered up the driveway just after 3 a.m. A light from inside the house blurred through the moulded glass of the front door. He turned the key in the latch and crept inside into the kitchen. His mother sat at the table in her dressing gown. There was a glass of water beside her. "Mum," said John, as if saying the word for the first time. She whispered to herself, "Mum, it's 3 in the morning. You all right? Where's Rory?" She lifted the glass, but she didn't drink any. "Needs me awake. Can't have me falling asleep," she said. Under the bright electric light, John could see the folded rings under her eyes, the sleep-seeking shadows creeping around the red rims and the lids. "What are you up at this hour for? You need to get some sleep." "Sure he'd go do lally if he thought I was asleep," she said. "Do lally? Why?" asked John. Silence. "The wolves," she said after a moment. "He reckons there's wolves round here at night."
And that is Wolves by Peter McCauley. That is the last of our 10 stories. Try to contain your nerves, writers sitting here in the front row of the Pavilion Theatre. We will take a short break and then our judges will announce the winners. And now the silence falls because the time has come. We are going to find out who has won the top prizes. We would like to remind, though, all 10 of our writers on our shortlist, their achievement, it's a huge one already. There are over 2,000 entries this year. And as our judges have already said, a notably high standard of those entries for any story to get into the shortlist. It has had many people batting hard for it along the way and many of our judging panel who help whittle down the entries to a long list for our final judges are here tonight rooting for you. To all 10 of you shortlisted writers, you are already winners and congratulations to you. But there's always a but. But of course, there can only be 3 top prizes. I'm going to ask our judge, Tristan Rosenstock, to announce third prize.
The yearning for and challenges of parenthood are beautifully woven together in this child's eye narrative. And we get a wonderful sense of how a young child learns to act beyond her years to help lighten the burden for those around her. The emotionally aware narrator, Ivy, is vivid and convincing. For these reasons, and with our congratulations, third prize in the RTE Short Story Competition 2025 in honour of Francis McManus goes to the author of Auntie and Anto and Ivy and Ava, Ian Feary.
That is third prize, €3,000 in the RTE Short Story Competition to Ian Feary for his story, Auntie and Anto and Ivy and Ava. I'm going to ask Jan Carson to announce our second prize.
Grief, when it arrives in our lives, will impact every one of us differently. In this deftly written and wildly accomplished story, we see one woman's journey with grief, interrogate it, celebrate it, and record it with unflinching humanity and true honesty. For these reasons, and with our warmest congratulations, second prize in the RTE Short Story Competition 2025 in honour of Frances McManus goes to the author of A Spectrum of Sorrow, Angela Flynn.
That is second prize, €4,000 to Angela Flynn for her story, A Spectrum of Sorrow. Now, the moment we've all waited for. Neil Hegarty, we need to hear who has won first prize, and best of luck, everybody.
What happens when we reach a moment, a pivot in our lives? Do we recognize this crucial moment? Do we act on our feelings and our instincts? This story leads us through this process into this time of choice, of reckoning, and it does so delicately and with tremendous skill. For these reasons, and with our congratulations, first prize in the RTE Short Story Competition 2025 in honour of Frances McManus goes to the author of Witness, Linda McCarthy.
You're not going anywhere. Congratulations, first of all. How do you feel?
Oh, my God, I'm completely shocked. Thank you so much. This is just... I wasn't even going to enter. I was too tired. I'd just like to say thanks to my husband, Dara, who's a great editor, and my parents for always letting me bring a book to GAA matches.
Tell us, where does your writing go from here, then?
Oh, well, hopefully this can go pay towards some childcare, and I'll have some time to take it further, hopefully.
And as for everybody else, has anybody forgotten? Because there was that moment when you're going to sit down and you forgot to say.
The rest of my family. I would thank my kids, but they're actually an impediment to my writing. Very cute, though. Very cute.
I feel like I shouldn't have asked the last question. Linda McCarthy, congratulations. This year's winner. Now, warmest congratulations to Linda McCarthy. She is the winner of the 2025 RTE Short Story Competition. What a fantastic achievement. That is nearly it from us here at the Pavilion Theatre. Huge thanks to all of the writers who've come here tonight again and all of those who participated in the competition this year for their brilliant works of the imagination that have kept us entertained this last few weeks. Thank you to our judges, Neil Hegarty, Jan Carson and Tristan Rosenstock for all of their hard work, and to Andrew Bennett and Katrina Nivoraku for those readings tonight. And thanks to everybody who showed up tonight. Thanks to our audience as well. Thanks to the fine team at the Pavilion Theatre who are always so careful when they look after us. Thank you to Mark Dwyer, Niall McMonagall and James Feeney who are on sound tonight. The arena team this evening was Ollie Hamilton, Paula Shields and Sheila O'Callaghan. Elaine Conlon is the broadcast coordinator for the Short Story Competition. Producer of the competition is Sarah Binchy, and the producer of tonight's programme was Sinead Egan. I'm Rick O'Shea. Thank you very much for joining us to play us out here tonight. David Kitt with Robert Wyatt Along the Way. Good night.
I'd like to dedicate this to a great friend of the arts and someone that I considered a friend myself. This goes out to the memory of Sean Rocks. Look out your window. See the day. There's a red moon coming, and the sea at play. As the rain saw land, and the day got filled. Love. racing and a thrill. Look at them two scheming, tripping off the tongue. Journeys in the making, songs remain unsung. Full moon in Jamaica, Willie Clancy County Clare. Shovea fiat la hoco. The color of your hair. Put on your jacket and let's go downtown. Hear the Camden racket. Sink another round. Don't forget the eggs and the bag of dill with the one you love out chasing. Look at them two scheming, tripping off the tongue. Journeys in the making, songs remain unsung. Full moon in Jamaica, Willie Clancy County Clare. I survey a fiat la hoco. The color of your